Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right. You're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio, spectacular Halloween edition. Of course, we've got Tina Martini of McDermott, Will and Emery, and Rich Lenkov from Downey and Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. You're listening to the audio version of this. Tina is dressed as a ghost. I am a skeleton, and Rich is Kim Kardashian. Just imagine that. Just picture it in your head. So, Rudy Giuliani's having a hard time paying off the first those two Georgia election workers he wrongly accused of election fraud. So, a judge this week ordered that he turn over the lease to his luxury Manhattan apartment. Syracuse law professor Greg Germain laid out to Newsweek the very strange court order. And we're lucky enough to have him back on Legal Face-Off to talk about it today. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
So, Professor, as Ryan mentioned, last week, Rudy Giuliani was ordered to transfer his New York apartment along with his car and some other valuable property, at least valuable to him, to two Fulton County election workers whom he accused of committing election fraud and who were awarded $148 million in their defamation lawsuit against him. These transfers of his property are being done into a receivership. Tell us more about the judge's order.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very unusual order. So the normal procedure by which people collect judgments is to get rid of execution and have the sheriff seize personal property and then go through a sale process that is dictated by state law. The New York statute, as an alternative to having the sheriff enforce the writ, they can appoint a receiver. And a receiver is a court officer who has a fiduciary duty to the parties, usually somebody independent, who collects the property and auctions and sells it off, either at a public auction or at a private sale. And the reason to use a receiver rather than the sheriff is that, some kinds of properties are unusual. And maybe this is one of them where he's got a lot of memorabilia and things like that that are pretty specialized. And the idea is that a receiver, a professional receiver, would be able to get a higher price. What's unusual about this is he has appointed the plaintiffs to be the receiver, which is very unusual. I think it is permitted by the New York statute, but it's not common. And I you could imagine a situation where you had like a financial institution who had a professional staff being appointed as a receiver, but it's very unusual to appoint a party who has no experience, no kind of professional experience, to act as the receiver to sell the property. But that's what she did.
So it's unusual, of course. Was there any authority cited for that? Or is this just basically within the judge's discretion to appoint this adverse party as the receiver?
Well, the statute says the judge can appoint a receiver, and that doesn't specify who. And so I would say it's very unusual to appoint someone who isn't a professional experienced receiver to act as a receiver. The statute does, though, suggest that a plaintiff can be the receiver, because it says that normally the receiver would charge fees, and those fees are deemed waived if the plaintiff is appointed as a receiver. It is possible to do. And I think, probably in like a rents and profits receivership, where you've got a lender that's foreclosing on property, and pending the foreclosure, they take over the building and collect the rents, it's probably not unheard of to have a financial institution say, we'll be our own receiver in this case. But very unusual, 0.2 election workers who have no experience liquidating properties like this to be the receiver.
Well, we were talking before the show about some how this is just a very strange case in a number of different ways, including the amount that was awarded is just astronomical compared to what we would say are perhaps comparable cases, although this is an unusual case. Against the backdrop of this huge award, why do you think the judge decided to appoint the plaintiff's receivers? I mean, it sounds like the law permits it, but given what appears to be a lack of experience by the plaintiffs, coupled with some really, I think, unusual and one-of-a-kind property, particularly Giuliani's sports memorabilia collection, et cetera, why do you think the judge did this? We'd love your comments on that.
Well, I think she's furious with Giuliani. I mean, the whole case where she, I mean, there was no trial on the merits of the case. This case was a default because she ruled that Giuliani didn't produce documents that he should have produced. And so she ordered that he's guilty as a default, not be on after a trial on the merits of the case. And so the only issue for the jury was how much, you know, we're instructing you that he's guilty of all this. How much in damages are you going to award? And the court was obviously very frustrated with Giuliani. And after this huge judgment was entered, he filed bankruptcy, didn't cooperate with his bankruptcy case. The bankruptcy case was dismissed for bad faith. And so, you know, it's been a long time. He hasn't paid anything. She was obviously fed up. And so she's saying, you know, turn over all your property to the plaintiffs and let them sell it off. Was it the right decision? You know, I'm very troubled by the decision, even though I believe completely that Giuliani was reckless in making these false charges. He's now admitted that these charges are false. And I think it was reckless to make these charges and very unpleasant for the plaintiffs who didn't do anything wrong. $148 million, you know, it just, people go to jail for 30 years and they get an award of, you know, $1 million. And so it just seems so out of whack to any reasonable amount of damages that the plaintiff suffered.
Professor, last question. One of the key assets that was awarded is Giuliani's 4 World Series rings that were gifted to him from the Yankees after their 4 World Championships while he was mayor. Even more valuable, arguably now, given the results of the World Series last night. Doesn't look like the Yankees are going to get a 5th anytime soon. Andrew Giuliani, his son, alleges that he was gifted the rings by his father at a 76th birthday party where Rudy Giuliani said, I want you to have these now. Number one, if that is true, will the plaintiffs be able to recover those rings, which, again, are a very valuable part of this judgment? And number two, what kind of discovery will happen to determine whether or not Andrew actually has these rings or was in fact gifted them?
Well, there's always a question of whether it was a fraudulent transfer. If it was a gift, there was no consideration for it. And the question is going to be, you know, what period of time, when did it happen? Is there proof that they were transferred? And whether that can be avoided, whether that can be set aside. And I don't know any of the background facts. You know, I know the allegation that he says it was given to me and my father doesn't own them anymore, but, the court will investigate that. And, obviously the receiver is the one saying, you know, turn it over. And if you don't turn it over, they will bring the action to enforce the turnover order. And so that'll get fleshed out by the courts. And there's also an issue regarding his condominium in Florida, which he's claiming is exempt. So there's a couple of title and exemption issues that are going to have to be determined.
Being in New York, does that mean you're a Yankees fan? Is Rich traumatizing you here?
No, that's okay. I'm a Californian, so
it's, oh, okay.
Celebration. Yeah, I'm a carpetbagger here in New York.
Professor Gregory Germain, thanks so much for coming on with us again.
Thank you. Take care.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkoff, now dressed as Gumby, for those watching at home, Atina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. A judge in Pennsylvania has put a lawsuit on hold that would have stopped Elon Musk's $1 million a day giveaway. Musk's attorneys want the lawsuit to go to federal court. Musk was not at today's proceedings. Michael Kang is Northwestern's Pritzker School of Law professor. He also co-authored the book Free to Judge: The Power of Campaign Money in Judicial Elections. He joins us today to talk about this. Welcome to Legal Face-Off.
Thanks for having me.
Might be easier if I take off the costume. But yeah, the Philadelphia DA brought this lawsuit to stop this this scheme where Elon Musk is giving $1 million a day until election day to a person in a battleground state who signed a petition supporting the Constitution. So there's some stuff going on this week. So could you just explain sort of the what the plan was and whether it does violate any federal laws?
Yeah.
So there's state laws.
Yeah, right. There's both a federal and a state law layer to this. Elon Musk had a giveaway program that's kind of developed over the month of October, where if you're a registered voter in one of the battleground states, you can sign a petition and you're eligible for a $1 million drawing every day from, I think at some point about a couple weeks ago, through the election. And I think they paused it at one point after they got a letter from DOJ, but they've basically continued that program through today, this morning, I suppose. And so the questions here are whether this violates federal law. There's a federal prohibition on paying people to register to vote. It's what we call a vote buying law. It's not quite vote buying in this case, but it would be paying someone to register to vote. That's illegal. And then separately, Larry Krasner has brought a lawsuit under state law. This as an illegal lottery under Pennsylvania state law. And so there's two different claims here that are going on. And the actions today really relate to the state law claims.
So according to the letter, though, of the law, it's arguable that Musk is not violating because it doesn't say technically that the contest doesn't say that you have to register. It says you have to be registered, right? So arguably, any registered voter already can be eligible for the sweepstakes. I guess you would have to go into the intent, and clearly the intent seems to be to sign up new registrants, right? So there's a little bit of a gray area here, obviously quite purposeful. Elon Musk certainly has deep pockets to hire lawyers who probably helped him craft this lottery.
That's exactly right. It's designed to try to avoid the problems with the federal prohibition on paying people to register to vote. This isn't directly paying someone to register to vote. It's not framed that way. Instead, you have to be a registered voter to be eligible for the drawing, and then you have to sign the petition in addition, although that's sort of this, you know, kind of meaningless add-on. Really, the idea here is to get people to register. And I think in the end, we still run into a problem under federal law. And I think that is not so much just the literal application of the giveaway, but it's actually when you consider the circumstances and context here, it does, as you said, seem clearly intended to financially induce people to register in time to vote for Trump in this election. You've got to be registered to vote to be eligible. It's only open to registered voters in the battleground states that are basically going to decide this presidential election. It runs right before the election, and it's open basically only until voters can't newly register to vote in these states for this election. So I think when you take into account all the circumstances, it's pretty clear what the intent here is. It's to register new voters in time to vote for Trump in this election. There's really no other reasons to structure the program like this. If it was run, you know, next summer, kind of unconnected to an election that's a month away, just to collect data and understand better what registered voters think about the Second Amendment, that I think would be totally fine. But I think the timing and the circumstances in which it's presented right now are what raise the problem under federal law.
All right. And so the state law case seems relatively simple. The allegation is that you're engaged in running a lottery that is strictly within the purview of the state's jurisdiction. Therefore, you ought to stop doing it, right?
That's exactly the claim, right? Pennsylvania, as far as I know, does not have a state law prohibition like the federal one on paying people to register to vote. So Krasner didn't have that option. So instead, what he's bringing is this claim under the state lottery law. He's saying that this is a game of chance in which people pay in to try to win a prize. And really, only the state of Pennsylvania is allowed to do that. It's not obvious to me that this is a lottery. I'm not an expert on Pennsylvania lottery law. There are very few people, I think, in that group, probably. But that's the claim. That's the claim he's bringing here to try to enjoin Elon Musk from running this program through the election.
All right. At the risk, back to the federal law, at the risk of sort of asking an obvious question, what is the problem with paying people to register to vote? I mean, after all, isn't getting more people to register a good thing? That's something that we want more people to participate in. What's wrong with paying those people?
Yeah, in fact, we incentivize lots of people to try to go out and register people to vote. It's okay to pay people to go and register to vote, and it's okay to make it easier for people to register to vote. I think the problem is kind of an analog to paying people to vote a certain way, to vote for Trump or to vote for Harris, that what we're doing is kind of intruding on people's autonomy to make these kinds of decisions about voting, guided by their conscience. And that's really kind of the goal of the law, and to protect that autonomy. If you allow people to be paid to vote a certain way, then they may not vote for who they most want to be elected. Instead, they'll do it because they need the money. And we're going to give disproportionate influence to people who have a lot of money to spend in that way. And I think paying people to register to vote is kind of along the same lines. It's not quite the same as paying someone to vote. But if you pay certain people who you know are predisposed to vote in a certain way, you're similarly allowing kind of wealthy people to use their wealth to kind of affect the election outcome, disconnected to what potentially, you know, what would happen if people were just guided by their own conscience.
Got it. Last question. Election is Tuesday, a few days away. Any chance any of this litigation gets worked out by then?
Well, I don't think it'll be worked out in the sense that we'll have a kind of legal determination about whether this violates either state or federal law. There's no way that's going to happen. And I think the whole reason for Elon Musk trying to remove the state law claim to federal court is just delay, really. That it seems like you could argue about the merits of Krasner's claim under Pennsylvania state law, but the removal claim seems unlikely to win. It's just an attempt to delay a hearing on the merits so that they can continue their program through Election Day. And once that's done, I think that they've achieved the kind of goals that they want. And whatever happens after that is just really water under the bridge.
You brought up an interesting point about registering data. I looked it up. You have to put in your name, your phone number, your email address, your regular address. I mean, this is a data mining opportunity, obviously, for the Republican Trump campaign as well. So very interesting. Professor Michael Kang from Northwestern University, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media at WGNRadio.com. Oh boy, we've got a new guest here. We've got a couple new guests, in fact. If you're looking at the boxes and watching this online, you'll see we've got a stable genius. Say hello, stable genius.
A lot of people saying it's rigged. It's rigged. They're like dogs.
Our Halloween episode has taken a turn here.
Dana.
All right. Chicago Lawyer Magazine, a print and digital publication, which you could subscribe to, by the way, for $149 annually, has some very familiar faces in the August-September edition for the Inside Out column. Our own Tina Martini, who is unmasked at this point, and David Sussler, also unmasked, Associate General Counsel for National Material LP, about professional developments, this conversation. David, thanks for coming on with us today to put into audio and video form what you put into print.
Thanks for having me back.
So great topic. It's been a while since Sussler and Martini as a combo have been on, so we're glad to have you back. Great column, as Ryan said, on the September 2024 Chicago Lawyer about something that, you know, we all want to do, but frequently don't have the time to do: professional development. Sussler, you've been professionally developing yourself for many years and continue to do so. What's something that you would tell young attorneys about the importance of professional development? Why is it so important? Why did you write about it?
Well, I think, you know, for me at least, it's most important to remember professional development isn't just attending a CLE class or reading an article. It's learning the skills about, as I often say, how to be a lawyer, how to conduct yourself professionally, how to act in court, how to act in a deposition or in a business meeting. How might you have a more productive conversation with opposing counsel or an opposing party as you're negotiating a contract? And I think the best way to do that is to do it in person. For a young attorney, go to the office in person and feel the energy in a room. See how lawyers, you got to see the body language. You can't really see body language that much on video. So things like that, those are all elements of professional development that I think sometimes can get lost, especially on younger attorneys.
You know, one of the things you write about in the excellent article is take pride in your work, own a project, right? I literally interviewed someone a few hours ago and told them, you know, we could talk all day about, you know, substance and whether you know the law, but what I want and what I look for in a new hire is very simple. Like, do you care? That's it. Three words. That's the magic. That's the secret sauce that I think we're all trying to get people to buy into, that encompasses lots of things. But do you care? And unfortunately, increasingly, people don't care. In our profession, you know, not enough people have the, you know, worry and concern and care about the product they're putting, not just to clients, but to judges, to opposing counsel, to your colleagues. So how do you find that quality in people, and how do you foster it in people that maybe are still working on it?
Great question, Rich. I mean, I completely agree with you. And I mentioned in the article that one of my biggest pet peeves is sloppy work. And I do think that there is a way to interview for it by giving folks what I would call examples, like how would you handle this situation? How would you handle that? While you can never necessarily definitively nail down how someone's going to act in a job versus what they say in an interview, I do think that there are indications with how someone interviews that will lead you and give you at least some level of clues as to whether or not they're going to be really focused on client-facing activities. And what I like to tell lawyers, especially when I'm working with them pretty regularly, I always give them my written feedback promptly. So they are getting professionally developed by me every day, sometimes several times a day. And what I tell them is you always have to put yourself in the client's shoes and think, if you received work product like this as a client, how would you react? Would you fire your lawyer? Would you get really upset at the lawyer? I don't think there's anything better than encouraging people to say, if you received this as the client, what would you think of this work product? And I think that's a really great way to frame the beginning of a conversation. And hopefully it's not a chronic thing. Hopefully people will improve, but sometimes they don't. And then it becomes a different conversation.
Yeah, excellent, excellent point. Sussler, in the article, you also mentioned that one of the best ways to foster your development professionally is not just through, as you mentioned, CLE or sitting through classes, but actually getting out there in the world and doing things, and most importantly, seeing people, right? Interact with people. If you want to become a great litigator, don't read about it. Go see people in action, right? Go sit. I tell people this all the time, literally. Go to the Daily Center. You're not going to find, you know, many better places on the planet to see and learn about litigation than the Richard M. Daley Center right here in Chicago that's open to the public. Go sit on a trial. You know, if you want to observe how, you know, how people operate in the job that you want to do, go to their place of work and see it, right? I mean, there's really no substitute for that.
Yeah, I agree 100%. You know, and it makes me think of, you know, a piece of advice my father gave me. My father was a lawyer. When I graduated law school and asked for advice, he said, always assume your opposing counsel knows as much or more than you do, but never assume you know more than they do. And, you know, as I grew up as a trial lawyer, you're a trial lawyer. But even if you're not a trial lawyer, go to court sometimes, because we all engage in the art of persuasion, right? And you learn just as much by watching the masters in action as those who are not the masters. But you also can't underestimate them, right? So, you know, part of it's for, I remember as a young lawyer sitting in some of the courtrooms thinking, look, if they can do this, I can do this, right? But you learn how to talk. You learn how to talk to opposing counsel. And it's not always the fancy highfalutin lawyer language that wins, right? It's knowing how to talk to people, and you develop that skill over time, and you see how other people do it. You figure out what works for me, what's authentic to me, but it's a constantly evolving thing. So yeah, get out there and see people. Just one last thing, a story I tell a lot. When I was a young lawyer taking a deposition, there were multiple defendants. And one of the hardest things to know is, when do you stop asking questions? How do you know not to ask that one question too much? And I was sitting next to a lawyer who was a few years ahead of me taking a deposition. And all of a sudden, he kicks me under the table. And I realized he was telling me to shut up. I had what I needed. You can't teach that lesson in a Zoom deposition, right? That lesson was close to 35 years ago, and I still remember it. And it is still an important part of my development as a lawyer to think about, do I have what I need and should I stop?
This is all great advice. Do you recommend younger attorneys dress up in costumes at the office?
On Halloween, if that's the culture, absolutely.
Including genius?
This is my lawyer costume.
Very good.
I got one more question for Tina. Tina, you know, we all want younger attorneys to engage in this, but also there's a benefit to firms, right? I mean, you're with a big firm, you've been, you know, supervising attorneys for many years. What's the advantage to the firm to have their associates and younger attorneys develop this way?
Good question, Rich. I'd say there are a couple of advantages. First, the quicker they develop and become ready to put in front of clients, the more the firm can make off of those attorneys by having them bill more hours and presenting them to clients. And there's also obviously a cultural aspect to it too. My firm is very keen on keeping a collaborative culture where we engender a working environment where people want to stay and flourish and get promoted. And so you really have to help attorneys develop in order to do that. And the flip side of that, Rich, is if you can't keep attorneys and they end up leaving, there's a high cost associated with training somebody who then ends up ultimately leaving, having to replace that person, potentially having to use a headhunter to replace that person and starting the cycle all over again. There's a whole host of ways that that costs the firm. And so in that way, it's clearly in the firm's best interest as well to train its attorneys to maximize their chances of success.
All right. The grand answer, the real last question is to Sussler and fans of the show, as we now celebrate our 10th anniversary on Legal Face-Off. And Sussler has been on probably the most out of anyone who is not on this Zoom in history. Everyone knows that we try to end off by weaving our favorite artist, Bruce Springsteen, into our question. And I don't know if you saw the Road Diary documentary yet on Hulu.
I have not watched it yet, but I will.
All right. So that takes us behind the scenes of the organization, the business now a 50-year business that is Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. Knowing Springsteen and the way he operates, even not having seen the documentary, what lessons can we learn from the way he operates his business over the last 50 years in terms of professional development?
Well, you know, he has...
How do you like that?
That's a great question. But Bruce has talked about sort of being a benevolent dictator. You know, he's talked about the rock business. You get a lot of crazy people who know nothing about business and do kinds of wacky, crazy things that aren't necessarily good for the band. So having a benevolent dictator like Bruce, where you come in and you sort of set boundaries, like you want to engage in your partying ways when you're off duty, that's just fine. But when you're on stage here, no, you toe the line because we have a job to do. And that comes first. So things like that, that's, I think, how he's exercised his hand in professionally developing his band.
And that's why there's only one boss. That's why they call him boss.
Well, I would like to. So I'd like to just mention also that, you know, he's a real introvert and he was in real peril to lose his record deal early on in his career. And I think he realized in terms of developing himself that he really needed to step outside his comfort zone and become much more of an entertainer and much more of an extrovert, even if it's not really who he is. In order to be able to flourish and not lose his record deal. So I think that's evidence of him professionally developing himself and realizing I'm not going to make it unless I step outside myself.
Great answer.
Nice.
I guess.
And who are you, Flash?
I'm the I'm the ring girl.
Oh. I was going to say, he almost looks like Richie Sambora.
Maybe Richie Sambora is the ring girl. You know, that's the creepiest, scary movie I've ever seen. And after the second time, Tina, maybe watch that movie, I'm done with scary movies.
I want to know how many other people have worn that wig.
Good question. It smells a little gamey.
David Susler, thanks so much for jumping on with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN. It's time for Legal Grab Bag. Oh, boy. If you're listening to the audio, we'll do the best we can. If you're watching, we apologize. First of all, we have the pleasure of being joined by Donnie Niehaus of Walton Niehaus. Donnie focuses on workers' compensation defense. He's a Louisville Cardinal and a Kentucky dad of four. Thanks for joining us, Donnie.
There we go. Thank you for having me.
And we have attorney Rebecca Edelman. She's an entrepreneur, influencer, thought leader in healthcare, senior living and risk management, and founder of Edelman Firm and Claims Management, an all-women firm. And her favorite ribs place in her hometown of Memphis is, Rebecca?
The Rendezvous.
She's a dry rub person. I would have accepted Blue City Cafe on deal as well. But
yes, I was just at the Rendezvous yesterday.
All right. Fantastic. All right. So we've got Tina and Rich was here, but Billy Joe Bob has joined.
I got unmasked.
He needed to breathe, apparently. If you're
take that mask off.
This is way scarier.
Listening to the audio stream, think of an extra in the movie Waterboy. That's essentially what he is, fully tatted, toothless, and ready to talk here. So All right, let's get down to it. Well, less than a week before the election, and we start off with Trump Watch Rich, or Billy Joe Bob, former president, Republican presidential nominee, is already beginning the drumbeat of a possible election fraud in Pennsylvania. And an old friend of his is a free man today. Why don't we get into Trump Watch a little bit?
I mean, I'd like to say that this is the last maybe edition ever of Trump Watch. So we have had Trump Watch as our lead in the grab bag now for many years because, friends, we know that Trump generates the incredible amounts of content legally. So we are indebted to him at least for that. But we know that this legal action won't end, even though the election is next week. And as Ryan mentioned, Tina, Trump this morning and yesterday was talking about how in York County, PA, there's thousands of fraudulent voter registration forms. That claim has already been debunked. There was an attempt accurately to submit some fraud, but that was caught. And that's an example, as the Pennsylvania AG has already pointed out. That's an example of the system working. So again, there's no evidence of any fraud. But the bigger picture point here, and one we'll talk about here in a moment, is that this won't end on Tuesday, right? There won't be a winner declared. But more importantly, Trump is already setting up this, these allegations that the election will be stolen. If we thought that those allegations were strong after both 2016 and 2020, I don't think we've seen anything yet. And then, as Ryan also mentioned, Bannon was released after 4 months in jail. He has, you know, said that empowered him, that emboldened him. So, you know, I think we're up for a very difficult week and then potentially months, if not longer, next week.
Agree, Rich. I mean, I think it's going to potentially be maybe even worse than people are forecasting in terms of not only what I foresee as being uncertainty around the definitive results of the election, but I think, you know, the narratives have been in, you know, spinning now for a while. I think folks want to cover all the bases, so to speak, in the event they win and the event they don't win. And, you know, the real concern here is the potential fomenting of a level of disruption, no matter what the election results are, where people are going to be super agitated, upset, and potentially feeling unsafe around it.
Yeah, Rebecca, what are your thoughts on these allegations? They're not surprising, I'm sure, but there's many more to come.
Yeah, not surprising. You know, I'm always the one to go to. I'm really not surprised by anything, but it focuses on things, particularly around here in my area down here in the South, that are the most important to me, which is like, you know, public trust in the whole process, the erosion of the public trust, kind of like what's going on, public perception, conversations where I'm just not going to vote, you know, this kind of idea. And I think the more we see this, the more I really have myself, I've been focusing on just sort of like the misinformation and this relationship with Elon and, you know, how that platform has just really kind of just amplified all of it. But I think the impact on, to me, it's like what's going to happen on the impact on voter behavior. So that's kind of my two cents on that. And I think there's a lot of complexities around the misinformation and the information platform and how this stuff is getting out and where you're reading it. And what's going to actually happen in terms of, you know, voter turnout. And anyway, that's how I feel about that.
Donnie, is the Stop the Steal Part 2 movement gaining some traction over by where you are in Kentucky?
Yeah, well, I mean, like Rebecca said, everything's been amplified just because I think the partisan podcast, your blogs, everyone's in their own little bubble. So they're getting one version of the event from their particular host. So they're expecting a victory. So when it doesn't happen, they're going to start saying it was thrown or it was fraudulent in some way. So I think that just heightens things and makes everyone a little more on edge when things don't go their way, whatever side of the aisle you're on. But yeah, I think it's just a different era with mail-in voting and all that kind of stuff. We're not going to have the results on election night like we have for many a year. So I think that just amplifies things as well.
All right. Well, from Trump Watch to Trump Watches, the former president has a new line of watches featuring his iconic fist pump after being shot. Rich, you can get one for the $499 base, $499 basic. There's also a $100,000 18 karat 122 diamond one. I've got the LFO credit card. How many do we need? And it sounds like these watches may also be an issue legally.
Well, first of all, we couldn't resist going from Trump watch to Trump watches, Tina, as a title. We love our titles here on Legal Face Up. But yeah, I mean, you know, he's selling a bunch of stuff. These watches, though, might violate copyright law, which unless he worked out some kind of deal, he might be, again, just added to the hundreds of cases that Trump are involved in. But Tina, this is, you know, your expertise. What's the story? Any jeopardy here from the Trump watch?
Yeah, no, interesting story, Rich. You know, there is a depiction of Trump after he was shot at, sort of doing the fist pumping and, you know, like, I'm alive, be happy.
Well, I'll recreate it. Hang on.
No. Yes, that is exactly what it looked like, Rich. You're violating copyright law.
Hold on, let me get my shoe.
Fight.
Well done. So that depiction of him is rendered on the watch and is based on a photograph that is now becoming pretty famous, owned by AP. And on that basis, because it's essentially a picture that was created based on a picture that is owned by somebody, that is with, and it's being used without permission, much like he uses people's songs during his campaigning. That is how, at least that's the theory of how it violates copyright law. So I guess the good news for Trump is that some of his watches don't have that on the back. But there is a relatively expensive bunch of these watches that do have this depiction on them.
Donnie, would you purchase a $100,000 Victory Tourbillon piece?
If I get a raise at work, I'll have to talk to my boss. But
there you go.
Yeah. No, that's a little out of my budget. My Rolex will have to do.
All right, Rebecca, don't use pictures, especially these days, without permission, perhaps, is the takeaway.
Yeah, I mean, not only that, but like just such a misrepresentation. I think I was reading in the piece also about, you know, like a Swiss made, you know, I'm thinking Swiss made, I'm thinking like a, you know, really nice watch. It's like Swiss Wyoming made, apparently. So like, I think it's this Best Watches on Earth LLC. That's, I want to know who started that company. So anyway, yeah, I think there's a lot of misrepresentation, a lot of copyright, you know, the copyright issues, but I think just more misleading consumers, undermining trust, just more of that, and just like in a watch form, I suppose.
Right. Greatest watches anywhere on the planet.
Everywhere.
All right, moving along. The Department of Homeland Security released a report last month showing an increase in domestic extremists chatting about a new civil war. Tina, I'm sure this chatter has been fueled by the upcoming election.
Yeah, Ryan. So understandably, as we're creeping closer and closer to the election, both the Department of Homeland Security and other U.S. intelligence authorities are saying that there is this uptick with anonymous domestic violent extremists who claim to be preparing for violence in their interactions and online chat rooms, and claiming that this potential imminent civil war would be linked to the election results. Depending on those results, the perception of election fraud, as well as whoever wins, what their position is on various things like immigration. You know, this is largely precipitated by what we saw starting on January 6th, as well as what's happened since then with many public officials and election workers who have been harassed and threatened. This Department of Homeland Security report actually mentions that there are a number of people who have already been facing criminal charges for promoting this idea of an imminent civil war and for making violent threats. There's actually somebody who's already been charged with murder for beheading his father in the name of saving America from traitors. The report says that a large-scale action by extremists is probably unlikely because law enforcement's been doubling down since January 6th. But Rich, they acknowledge that extremists, you know, get savvier as these things evolve, and they're increasingly using encrypted channels. So they're really alerting local law enforcement to be mindful, particularly as we are opening, you know, different polling places and the aftermath of the election, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's like there's unprecedented amounts of chatter online. You know, it's kind of unbelievable how much protection these election workers needed are needing, and how much infrastructure is being built. You know, in prior years, you would never think you would have to build these, like, you know, prison like polling places, but that's what we need now. But there's also, like, as much, I think, concern about the left as there is the right. Right. I mean, most people are thinking that the right are going to engage in some kind of protest. But, you know, there's lots of talk also about, especially in the wake of the protests we saw dealing with the Gaza-Israel situation, that those same people will mobilize if Trump wins. So, yeah, I think there's lots of concern and lots of reason to be extra vigilant next week. Donnie, Rebecca, what are you hearing? What are you seeing? What are you concerned about?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Donnie.
No, go ahead.
I know our Secretary of State's done a terrific job, and what I've read around the country, everyone is hyping up or bulking up all the security around the election sites, which I haven't seen anything on the ground that suggests anything's going to go haywire down here. But yeah, no, they're really taking everything into consideration and making sure nothing goes crazy. But I think you're seeing all this again. Everything's become so hyper-partisan, and the extremes on both sides have started taking over each respective party. So that's not helping anything out.
Yeah, and I think from sort of the you know, just for out of interest of being in the grab bag and having an interesting perspective on it, you know, I think we're also talking about, you know, some First Amendment stuff too. And I think there's been some conversation around First Amendment and where the balance is. And I think that's sort of an important part of the conversation. But I also see, particularly where I am down here, that, you know, these extremist positions, they're able to capitalize on this sort of socioeconomical imbalances and disparities. And so I think we're seeing that more than ever now. And then, you know, our politicians just trying to sort of optimize a platform with that particular demographic is a big concern for us down here.
All right, moving along, a judge has dismissed a second lawsuit over the 1968 film Romeo and Juliet. Tina, what's going on here?
Ryan, there's obviously been a lot of different versions of Romeo and Juliet. The 1968 version with Olivia Hussey and Leonard Whiting is among the most famous. They were 16 and 17 at the time that they starred in it. There's a famous bedroom scene. I have not seen it, but apparently both actors appear partially naked. And that scene that became the subject of this lawsuit back in 2022, where they claimed that they had been duped by the film's director, who is now deceased, into appearing naked in the film. And they made claims that it amounted to child pornography. The judge back for this case, this first iteration of this case, disagreed, tossed the lawsuit partly on statute of limitations grounds. After a digitally restored version was released after this case was dismissed, both Hussey and Whiting sued again, claiming that this re-release triggered a new statute of limitations. And they also filed the lawsuit claiming that this new version violated revenge pornography laws. So last week, the judge dismissed this lawsuit too with a couple of interesting findings, Rich. First, he found that the re-released version was not so different from the original to trigger a new statute. He also found that the actors consented to their appearance in the film. They not only had contracts to make the film, but even if they hadn't had contracts, he says, after nearly 60 years of making appearances and making statements about their appearance in the film and talking about this very scene without objecting, that this amounts to an implied ratification and approval of the film. What also has emerged here, Rich, is that they only made about $2,200 for appearing in the film, and they both claim that they feel like they were exploited and traumatized. They were expected to appeal, but I suspect that that has a big that's a big reason why they sued in the first place. If you're making $2,200 to appear in a film that became this popular, I can understand feeling cheated, not rightfully, but that would be their frame of reference on it.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Nirvana cover, you know, the Nevermind album cover that we've covered, the story that we've now covered a couple times, where the baby that was depicted on that famous album cover later sued many times, alleging that he did not consent to use, you know, to the use of his naked body on the cover of that album. And one of the reasons the case was dismissed was because that individual had exploited, had used that image many times to his economic benefit. And the judge said, you can't have it both ways. Similarly here, you know, these people have, you know, appeared at events over the years, have promoted the film. You know, you understand the perspective that, listen, I didn't make any money on the film, so I have to get whatever I can out of it. But I think the judge here similarly said, you know, you can't have it both ways. You use the film to your advantage, therefore you can't now use it, alleging that you were harmed by it. So I think there's some common sense that's been applied to this case. Rebecca, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, just from my legal perspective, you know, at some point, it's got to end at some point. I mean, at some point, your rights got to be either extinguished or you exercise them or you don't exercise them. But I think the interesting thing here when I was looking over the case was that, you know, they did sort of promote themselves. And so I think that was a really big part of that decision. And, you know, luckily we've got good labor laws now, or involving labor laws and employment laws and child labor laws. And, you know, I think we've got maybe some more ethics in, you know, filmmaking. I don't know. But I think if anything else, it you know, at least puts a spotlight on what we need to be talking about in terms of children and children in entertainment.
Continuing with the Halloween theme here, a Tennessee haunted house is apparently so scary, it's been dubbed a torture chamber, makes patrons fill out a huge waiver. I'm talking like chapters. Rebecca, this is about 3 hours east of you. Rich, I'm not going to lie, I couldn't get through the photos on this story from the New York Post. It looks just terrifying.
McCamey Manor. We're famous for it.
Have you been there?
No.
Did you write this 40-page waiver?
No, I didn't write the 40. And the interesting thing about it is there's all sorts of interesting things about this. So I was thrilled to see it come up on the playlist today. But maybe starting from the, well, you know, there's been lots of investigations around it. A really recent investigation, maybe in March or January, March of this year, you know, violations of consumer protection laws. And the guy who, you know, who owns McCamey Manor, he is a staunch, he will not give up. He filed his own lawsuit, protections, all sorts of constitutional protections. The waiver's like, you can't even get a copy of the waiver, I think, until you get there. Like, until you've actually mustered up all the courage to go to the McCamey Manor, then you get a 40-page. That's probably the scariest part of McCamey Manor, the actual release itself.
Yeah, so, the legal part is the scariest part, right?
It's the scariest part. But interestingly enough, when I was trying to get some sort of recent updates on this, he himself is in some legal trouble, and I think he was just within the last couple of months. I don't know. He was arrested for domestic violence, for all sorts of different charges. And then, you know, there's been a lot of backlash, you know, from the public around it. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty famous. I think there's the documentary on it. If you haven't seen the documentary on it. Yeah,
he was arrested, as you mentioned, over the summer, Tina, for attempted murder, rape, and domestic assault. For an incident with his girlfriend, the charges were later dropped. But, you know, I first of all, I love haunted houses. I've worked in them, as you can imagine. I've worked in them. So, you know, one of the sort of bedrock principles, Tina, as you know, is like, don't touch them, they won't touch you. This one throws out those rules out the window. They actually touch you. They hold.
No safe words.
Yeah, there's no safe words. But from a legal perspective, you know, this 40-page waiver caught my attention because I deal a lot with waivers, and most people who deal with them know, like, secret is they're not really enforceable. And a 40-page one is really hard to enforce. I mean, imagine how difficult it is to enforce your average 1 or 2-page document when you go to, like, you know, a trampoline park or an amusement park. Those are difficult because you have to prove that the patron knew about it, understood it, read it, was in an equal bargaining position. But I can't imagine that this is enforceable, even in Tennessee, that you were able to show that the average fan understood, read, comprehended a 40-page legal document. I'm sure it's full of lots of difficult-to-read language, especially in the dark.
Yeah, I don't even, it's never been challenged, interestingly enough. The waiver's never been challenged. I don't think it'd be upheld here in the state of Tennessee. But yeah. I think that, you know, you just, by the time you get there, if you decide you're going to go, imagine how far you've already come. You're going to sign anything. That's, I guess, the point.
I got to go. Tina, we got to make a road trip.
I can't. Well, I think they're going to shut it down. Too bad, Rich. We missed our window. But yeah, I mean, even being a lay person, let's pretend we're lay people for a second. The notion of signing something that's 40 pages, I think that this just appeals to the thrill that people are looking for. And they probably think it's going to be even more thrilling the longer the waiver is, kind of like, you know, seeking danger, going to like a Six Flags or some kind of an amusement park where it's like the more dangerous, the better. I think that that's how a lot of people think about it. But from what was being described, I can't believe that this place was open as long as it was, Rich.
It's an interesting one. Donnie, the allegations are that they were waterboarded, tased, whipped, taunted with spiders, trapped in boxes. Is this a good use? Rebecca mentioned that the Attorney General of Tennessee is looking into this. Is this a good use, though, of the Attorney General's time?
No.
Shouldn't people allowed to be scared?
Yeah, well, these people know exactly what they're getting into. I mean, Like you said, there's a Hulu documentary. I know about it. I'm never going to go there, but you know exactly what you're getting into. Whether you're going to read the whole 40-page document, you just know from reading from friends, what have you, that this is not your typical haunted house. This is intense. I don't think anyone's even made it through the entire house, from what I understand. But at some point, you're not being coerced to do this. You've consented, and you know what you're getting into.
Spoken like a true defense lawyer.
Yeah.
And Billy Jones.
Comparative false.
But one of the things, too, is they offer an award, you know, a reward. If you could, I guess that's what the AG is looking into that, too, that there's you can't really get it. It doesn't exist, this whatever it is, $17,000, $10,000 reward. But anyway.
Interesting. All right. Well, we always talk Trump, and we usually talk Taylor Swift at some point during the legal grab bag. So. She makes people do bizarre, strange, over the top, and sometimes illegal things. Rich, what did some dude in Miami do to get into her Eras tour?
I mean, he pretended he was a security guard. I'm sure it's not. I'm sure there's been lots of examples of this because, man, what are they charging right now, Ryan, for tickets? I think to walk in, the cheapest seat in Toronto next week is like $3,000. I know that because I am trying to go to this show, but. $3,000 will get you the worst seats in the house. So you kind of understand people's desire to spend less than that. But yeah, this was obviously not the way to go. This guy was arrested, Tina, for, he was falsely impersonating an officer, interference with a sporting or entertainment event. He's an Italian national. So maybe, the rules are different in Italy, perhaps. But, he invented speaking of costumes, you know, he was dressed as a security guard, had some fake ID and said he was escorting people to their seats or something, but didn't work out.
No, I mean, I think the most innocuous version of this story is, as you profiled, that he was looking to get free, like a free ticket, essentially. Right. But given what we have seen poor Taylor Swift and other entertainers going through when they're appearing at different concert venues, is that sometimes it isn't innocuous, and you've got people who are trying to hurt a lot of people by planting a bomb or driving a car through a crowd or whatever the case may be. So who knows what this guy was really up to?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that there's some serious, potential damage that can be done here, Donnie. We've seen, like Tina mentioned, lots of examples of that. I mean, Tina, Taylor Swift herself had to cancel her Vienna shows, leaving, I think it was 200,000 fans stranded because there was a terrorist threat. So this stuff is obviously taken very seriously, as it should be.
Yeah, I used to be a beer vendor in a former life for the Cincinnati Bengals, Houdet. And you'd be shocked how lax the security is at these stadiums. Someone I know, not me, of course, could allow friends to come in just by showing an ID. So it is scary. They're not vetting anybody. And it's you usually have an hour, like a part-time security guard just letting these people in. So it's something of concern, obviously on a much greater level for Taylor Swift.
All right. Well, certain professions have busy seasons. We know the package delivery industry starts ramping up during the holidays, the flower industry around Mother's Day. Believe it or not, around the Super Bowl, plumbers tend to get a lot of business. And Tina, Halloween is apparently a scary time for lawyers.
Fine. So this is the beginning of what I would say is my favorite season on Legal Face-Off. Over the 10 years that we've been on the air, we love talking at the holidays about all these wacky lawsuits, and Halloween is no different. We've seen over the years these lawsuits for Halloween falling into a few buckets, the first being people who can't seem to make their way through a haunted house. They go to get scared, and then they overreact when they get scared, and then they hurt themselves and then think someone needs to pay for it. Then there's those cases where people wearing costumes, many of which are homemade, are flammable, and then they catch fire, and then they try to sue people like Johnson or companies like Johnson & Johnson, saying they should have warnings on cotton ball containers that that they're not flammable, that they are flammable and they could cause a fire. And then let's not forget the cases of the people of crazy Halloween decorations, particularly on their front lawns, that cause some kind of a local ruckus. My personal favorite from the cases we were looking at for this show is the one from a few years ago in Bloomingdale, Illinois, where there was a dispute involving some Halloween tombstones that were put out on a lawn, mocking neighbors who had been complaining about an RV that was parked on their block. They got the police involved, and the tombstone creators really ramped it up by filing a lawsuit in federal court claiming that their First Amendment rights would be violated if they couldn't put the tombstones up, making fun of their neighbors. The court not only agreed, but called the lawsuit frivolous. But so, Rich, this is what's really interesting. We always talk about these cases. I know there were a few others that we looked at, but I hope that you're not going to create a lawsuit over there with all the costumes you've got. Hopefully you don't have an open flame.
Well, I feel like wearing a morph suit depicting a naked hillbilly is my First Amendment right. And I'm willing to take on any comers who decide to challenge that in court. Rebecca, you saw these stories. Any of them jump out? I mean, at the end of the day, it's like Halloween gives people the license to act dumb and also file dumb lawsuits that are meritless, right? I mean, suing a haunted house because you're scared is dumb.
One of them I saw, I have my own personal story, but one of them I saw was the guy who filed the lawsuit for emotional distress. He was chased with a chainsaw. You know, someone from there, he was getting chased down the street with a chainsaw, emotional distress damages.
Right.
When I my first house, I had all the big decorations, everything. And I had a little thing that I was on my door, and inside the door, I can press it. So when they would knock on the door, I'd press a little button and a terrible loud scream would come up. So I pressed it, and I didn't realize it was like a 3-year-old who went screaming down my stairs at my thing and fell and hurt herself. I mean, just like this blood curdling scream. I got rid of that right away. The attraction as well as the lawsuit. So.
Wow. All right, Donnie, we will start. We will end the show and we will start with you. We like to go around the horn and learn something about our guests. We're Halloween, so let's talk about scary movies. We all love scary movies around Halloween. I love them all year round. What is your all-time favorite scary movie?
This might surprise you. I'm not a big scary movie guy, but I do like Halloween, the original.
The original, the OG.
The music gets you.
Absolutely. All right, Rebecca, favorite scary movie?
Without question, The Shining. That was scary to me.
All work and no play makes Jack dull boy. I'm not going to hurt you. I'm just going to bash your brains in.
Stop!
Wendy, darling, light of my life. Favorite scary movie?
Scary movie. How about that? I mean, that one came out kind of around the time I was in high school. And
The Wayans Brothers classic.
Yeah, exactly. Well, wait a minute. Scary movie. That was the comedy.
No, you're talking about Scream.
Scream. That's the one. Scream. Yeah. Okay.
Whose original title was Scary Movie.
Okay.
Confusing everyone around.
Yeah, no, I'm confused. Scary Movie came out after as kind of a spoof on Scream. Scream is the one. Final answer.
Good one. Tina.
If we're going based on just level of fright, I would say The Ring.
Mm. Oh.
The Ring, huh? I know.
Oh no. Oh, that's the movie that my husband said after that he would never watch another scary movie with me again. So it's been a few years since I've been able to watch scary movies with anybody. I usually watch them by myself or don't watch them at all.
Gosh.
The Ring.
Again, I think you look like Richie Sambora more than you look like the Ring girl, but that's just me.
All right. Leslie and Lisa, do you want to give us your favorites?
Poltergeist was mine.
Ooh. Oh. Mine was Insidious.
Oh, Insidious is good. I'm having trouble. My favorite is, you took two of my favorites, Halloween and The Shining, two of my favorites. I would say my next one is Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It encompasses three things I'm frightened of. Chainsaws, massacres, and Texas.
There were no mentions of Blair Witch anywhere in there. That was another overrated one that I expected to hear. Overrated.
I agree with Rich. That was overrated. I was
but
not
it was under budget.
At all.
Overrated, but under budget, right? So there you go. All right. Tweak it. Billy Joe just disappeared. Oh, there we go. There we go.
I can't resist. So
I'm gonna end it with a silence. So I end it with the Silence of the Lambs dance.
I just want to tell everyone that if you're listening to the audio version, thank you very much. But we highly encourage you go and watch the video version on social media, you will get the.
Don't stand up.
I guess at this point, the full
stand
Monty.
Stand up or bend over.
Okay.
No.
I'm going to play everyone out here. Thank you very much, Rebecca Edelman and Donnie Niehaus. And that'll do it for this latest installment of Legal Face-Off on WGN. Special thanks to Syracuse Law Professor Gregory Germain, Northwestern Professor Michael Kang, and Associate General Counsel for National Material LP, David Sussler. Also shouts out to Ben Anderson, Lisa Stiegel, for Tina Martini, and Billy Joe Bob. Oh, boy, this is going to be a tough image to get out of all of our heads. I'm Ryan Burrow. Thanks for joining us on Legal Face Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question? Just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget.